Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We trust you all had a safe and happy Thanksgiving with your family. Jim, I hope you did as well, at least until the Jets game started. And then.
Oh, you had to bring that up, huh? How bad is it, Greg? Fireman Ed has quit. He's no longer leading the cheers. So that's how bad, you know. Other than that, it was a lovely holiday weekend, Greg.
Yes, absolutely. On to martini number one now, the good news. And this actually has been getting better and better over time, considering how horrified most conservatives were when this started about all the classified information that the Obama administration gleefully passed along to Oscar-winning director Kathryn Bigelow to put together the movie on the Navy SEAL strike against Osama bin Laden. It's called Zero Dark Thirty. The first good news came out weeks ago when we found out this was not going to be a propaganda film that was going to come out right before the election to try and influence people. Now we find out that it's not even a puff piece about the president at all. News reports suggest that he's hardly in it, and when he is, he's just on a TV in the background, and it really is the story of the CIA and obviously of the raid itself. And so it looks like not only it's going to be a good film, but it didn't reveal a lot of state secrets, hopefully, despite the Obama administration's carelessness. So happy martini to Kathryn Bigelow, it looks like here, Jim.
The first review is out. It's pretty darn positive. It's worth, by the way, you said that there wasn't a propaganda piece. That was handled by the Harvey Weinstein made-for-TV version that aired on National Geographic about the weekend before the election. That was the one where National Geographic said to them, you have to take out the footage of Mitt Romney. As a lot of people had said, traditionally, if you're making a bin Laden raid film, you'd think the villain would be bin Laden. You know, that kind of... kind of an easy call there. But Harvey Weinstein and the other Hollywood crowd decided that Mitt Romney was the real villain. And the whole scene of Romney firing suppressive fire, trying to help bin Laden escape, really stretches the truth to me. This story, as soon as this came out, it came like, all right, here it comes. Here comes the Hollywood version that glamorizes the Obama administration. And I am kind of struck by, one, this phenomenon. And you think about when we saw that HBO made the movie Game Change, this need to take recent historical events and provide a Hollywood version of them, to cast big-name stars in depicting recent events that we all watched ourselves. It just seems kind of strange and unusual. One of the things that made Argo, the new Ben Affleck movie, so enjoyable is that it depicts something we didn't know about, this kind of hidden chapter of U.S. history with Iran. So I'm glad that this is not turned into a propaganda piece. And if you're going to do a movie like this, I'm glad they're not focusing on the Washington part, because honestly, I can't imagine how you make this a really interesting story with a bunch of people sitting around the table saying, okay, let's go get them. Although having said that, I did find out in this most recent review, Greg, James Gandolfini, best known as Tony Soprano, has been cast as Leon Panetta. This is either going to be – now, James Gandolfini, as we all know from The Sopranos and other films, is this very charismatic actor. It'll be fascinating to see whether he captures Panetta or whether we just see, Tony Soprano saying, let's whack this guy bin Laden and see how that shakes up. Considering our fears that this was going to be a gift-wrapped air kiss to the Obama administration, it looks like the good folks in Hollywood did figure out the real story is about the intelligence agencies and our men in uniform and all of the build-up to that. It also is apparently – it opens with a big scene of waterboarding, and I don't know whether it will be seen as – this is horrifying and the U.S. should never do this, or, well, this was necessary. We needed to do this to get the information to get these bad guys. That's one of those things where I actually have no real gripe with that. I don't mind depicting something like that in a way that, kind of suggests a certain amount of nuance or two sides of the story. I think it is reasonable to be hesitant about waterboarding because, we don't want to be a country that engages in torture or does anything more than we have to in this realm. It's getting to a morally gray area. But anyway, so it looks like a good film for the holiday season. And boy, nothing says holiday laughs and cheer like watching bin Laden get killed. Right, Greg?
Hey, I'll buy popcorn for that. So, obviously Kathryn Bigelow knows what she's doing. She won an Oscar for The Hurt Locker. And this is obviously in sort of the same realm. And kudos to her if this is, in fact, a really good film. So the bad martini is in Egypt. It's been interesting over the past few weeks that Mohamed Morsi has gone from this fringe character, leader of the Muslim Brotherhood political faction in Egypt, who originally said that they would never put up a presidential candidate. Then, of course, they did, and he won easily. Then he had all sorts of horrible things to say about Israel. Then suddenly he was this critical broker in this ceasefire. We'll see how long it lasts between Hamas and Israel. And then just when he's starting to gain a little bit of credibility on the international stage, he goes ahead and unveils these new laws that basically give himself power that are not subject to judicial review or many other things. So a lot of the people who were in Tahrir Square for the right reasons almost 2 years ago are back there now, not very happy with the way things are going. Curiously, the president of the United States, who was only too happy to jump out in front of the parade that had started long ago when it looked like Mubarak was going to fall, and he ultimately did, nothing to say so far on this, as Morsi basically does exactly what the Egyptians got fed up with Mubarak for doing.
I recognize that Middle East policy is a, you know, to paraphrase that old saying about Russia, a mystery wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in a chewy center of more mystery and enigmas. There aren't a lot of really great options, but now we have managed to get really the worst of both worlds. Because remember, the option was, do we stay with the pro-American secular strongman, or do we stand with the people who are likely to be manipulated by the Muslim Brotherhood? Well, here we are. We've got the Muslim Brotherhood and who's turning into an autocrat. Most ominous about this, I look in the Wall Street Journal today, is, you know, more than 24 tents were pitched in Tahrir Square, where several hundred opponents of Mr. Morsi amassed. We all remember Tahrir Square is when the, you know, protests and uprising against Mubarak was centered. This time the scene shifted to a road leading to the U.S. Embassy. So what's fascinating is that even though people are angry at us for not standing with them against Mubarak, we have now gotten into the game late enough so that we are now seen as supporters of Morsi. So we've now in those circumstances where we are getting literally the worst of both worlds. We are seen by a whole bunch of the Egyptian people as being, you know, friends of the last stooge, Mubarak. Now we're friends of the current stooge. And yet, if this uprising continues, I have a sneaking suspicion that this populist uprising is not going to end up in a more pro-Western leader. So, terrible mess. It's good to know we've got smart, tough diplomacy in the Obama administration to handle all this. You know, besides the traditional $1 billion a year we give them in foreign aid, apparently, I wonder if we're still on board for the $1 billion in debt forgiveness, which was designed to help out the new government there. I'm going to have to check in on that. All of those policies certainly are worth another rethink in light of these latest provocations from Morsi.
So we'll see how the administration handles this. Their handling of Egypt and Libya, their North African record, not good, but we got four more years to see if they can get it right. Yay. Jim, onto Martini number three now. And, you know, we gave out gifts on Friday, kind of Black Friday-type political gifts. We've got one more subtle gift for our listeners. We focus on a column by Susan Estrich. The gift is that we don't actually have sound of her talking. because if you know who Susan Estrich is, it's sometimes a painful experience. But she wrote this opinion piece saying that she voted for Obama. She voted for Obama because he got out of Iraq and is about to get out of Afghanistan. She wanted to keep Obamacare. She wanted to keep abortion legal, but she did not vote for Obama because she thinks she's paying too little in taxes. So she is against raising taxes on her income bracket, i.e. the rich, by Obama standards, as part of resolving the fiscal cliff situation. Apparently, Jim, Susan Estrich doesn't realize when you vote for the person, it's a tacit endorsement for all their policies. It may not be the reason you voted for them, but by helping to reelect them, you push forward their agenda, which includes higher taxes, which may very well be part of the fiscal cliff solution, if we want to call it that.
Look, Susan Estrich had her choice. And you got to, you know, talking to a pollster a few years ago, he talked about the hierarchy of values. We all have our single most important issue to us and our secondary issues there. Clearly, not raising taxes was a secondary issue for her. It was no secret that Barack Obama wanted to raise taxes. And anybody who could do math was looking at it and saying, well, there's no way he'll be able to go anywhere near trimming the deficit if he just focuses on the rich. By the way, Obama loves to use this phrasing, we're going to ask the wealthiest to pay a little bit more. Well, we're not asking anyone. If you politely decline, they will send you to prison. So it's, you know, when you say a little bit more, we're talking 3 or 4 percentage points of your income. So, I mean, that's not, you know, a little bit more in the grand scheme of things. Yeah, they're not asking for 100% of your income. But, you know, ask anyone, are you okay with giving 3 to 4 more percentage points of your income to the government? Most people will recoil and say no. What we're seeing in Estrich here apparently is a rather frustrating, also worth noting, perhaps one of the things that's driving Estrich crazy is, you know, when we think about talking about the wealthiest Americans, most people think of Warren Buffett, who's got his op-ed in the New York Times today calling for higher taxes, Bill Gates, rock stars and professional athletes and movie stars, people living millions upon millions. Well, Obama wants to raise taxes for households, not individuals. Households making more than $250,000 a year, which basically comes out to you know, each couple, part of a couple making about $125,000 a year. Now, if you're making less than that, that probably seems like a lot of money. And, you know, for a lot of folks, that you are doing pretty darn well when you're making that. However, in a lot of parts of the country, including, you know, New York City, the West Coast, a lot of parts of the country that have a high cost of living, $125,000 a year is not really wealthy. That's what you could say a solidly middle class existence, maybe trying to put a little aside for retirement or something. But, you know, cost of living and you know, particularly progressive taxation rates in states like California and Hawaii and places like that, man, that's going to eat up that high income really quickly. So here's Susan Estrich thinking that she's going to, you know, the tax hikes are going to hit those evil rich people, the more money they know what to do with. Clearly, she's somewhere making off probably in this neighborhood of $250,000 for household income. And all of a sudden, she's facing a big tax hike and she doesn't like it. Well, gee, you had that choice before you in November. There was no, you know, Mitt Romney, the guy who you kept demonizing, was not going to raise your taxes. You've made your bed and now you have to sleep in it. And this is kind of, you know, baffling to see this. I was saying over at Ace of Spades blog, apparently they're encountering more people who are like this, people who are complaining that their taxes are going up, but who voted for Obama. And you're kind of left shaking your head saying, well, why is this a surprise to you? So it's a shaking my head. It is a crazy martini, the cognitive dissonance amongst a lot of folks on the left who end up being hurt by this and who then have the gall to complain about tax rates after saying that we needed to raise taxes is kind of baffling and fascinating. Now, one other interesting is that you see Estrich saying that, you know, by winning about 50 to 48 or 50 to 47.5, Obama doesn't really have a mandate to raise taxes. It's really kind of interesting. I'd love to see more Democrats feeling that way. I don't think, you know, I think Obama could have won by one vote nationwide and he would have considered it a mandate. So I don't really think that's going to be an argument that's going to fly very much. It may be some opportunity here on the right for saying, hey, look, you know, Obama barely won and here he is enacting, you know, broad sweeping changes to our nation's tax system and our economy.
Yeah, I don't feel sorry for Susan Estrich, although she does live in California. So in addition to the fiscal cliff tax hikes that may be coming, people who don't make that much in her state also raised her taxes as a result of the referendum out there. So good times, people in California. Good times.
You're starting to remind us of Nevada, California.
Jim,
way to go, California. Way to go.
Exactly. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.